This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, welcome back to a new year of the Religion and Ethics Report. It's Andrew West here on RN and on your pod. Soon the truth behind the hit new movie, The Two Popes. Hint, it isn't all soccer beers and a gentle ribbing between two old priests. Also, the Queen said 2019 was a bumpy year. How much did she lean on her faith to get her through? We'll ask the author of a new book. And the Japanese diplomat who defied orders and saved thousands of Jews during World War II. All that's coming up.
I've struggled to do what must be done, but I've lost.
Popes can't resign. If you do this, you will damage the papacy forever.
I can no longer sit on the chair of St. Peter.
You're mistaken. You are...
Silence!
Well, that's a little bit of the Oscar-nominated movie, The Two Popes. And if you've seen it, you'll know that it ends with Francis and his predecessor, Benedict, cheering on their teams as Argentina and Germany play each other in the Soccer World Cup. Now, this fictional account of their relationship is drawing millions of viewers. But in real life, there's a widening gulf between the so-called Francis and Benedict factions of the church. The cause of this latest tension is a new book, supposedly co-written by Benedict, about compulsory celibacy for priests. But could hardliners in the church actually be using the 93-year-old former pontiff to undermine Francis? Writer Austin Ivory has his own book about Francis coming out soon, but for now, I wanted to know about the book that's ignited the crisis.
It's called From the Depths of Our Hearts. It's written in French, and it is written by Cardinal Robert Sarah, a very conservative curial cardinal originally from Guinea. The book is a defense of mandatory priestly celibacy, a very strong, one might say radical theological case for keeping celibacy the norm in the Latin or Western church. And the book has a contribution by Pope Emeritus Benedict, also arguing in favour of mandatory celibacy, but not with the same kind of radicality.
You say, in fact, in a recent piece for Commonweal magazine, a very interesting essay, and we'll put a link to it on our website, that this very conservative anti-Francis cardinal, Robert Sara, has basically co-opted Benedict. Is that right?
There's a huge controversy over what Benedict agreed to when he gave Sara his contribution to this book. So, I mean, the letters have been published by Sara, and they say, you know, Benedict says, look, I've got a few thoughts here on celibacy. I know you're writing this book. Please feel free to use these however you like. So he gave him permission to use his text. But the problem is that the book then appeared with Pope Benedict as the sort of principal author. In other words, the book is co-authored, but it says Benedict the 16th and then Cardinal Robert Sarah. So it makes it look as if the whole book has been written by the two of them. Mm. And what's happened is that Benedict's office, his secretary, has made clear that Benedict never consented to that. He never agreed to co-author a book, and he's not responsible, in other words, for Sarah's section, nor did he co-write the introduction and conclusion, as the publishers seem to think.
Yeah. At the core of this, as you say, Austin, is this argument as to whether Pope Francis should ordain a very small number of married priests to serve those very remote communities in the Amazon. You know Latin America very well. Just how desperate is the situation for ordinary Catholics in the Amazon? Do they need married priests, even a handful?
Well, the Amazonian region is in its own category, even within Latin America, where there's generally a shortage of priests. I mean, Amazonia, you can go a whole year without seeing a priest. So the effect for many of the Catholic communities in the area is that they've ceased to be sacramental communities, which, of course, is one of the basic essential characteristics of the Catholic Church, is the access to the sacraments.
That is, they can't take Holy Communion without a priest.
Exactly, or indeed confession. So this was the subject of a three-week synod of bishops back in October last year, which looked at this question very carefully and concluded with a recommendation that the Pope allow for married deacons, that's to say members of the clergy who are not yet priests, of whom there are many in the Amazon, to ordain them, give them a special kind of ordination that allows them to celebrate the sacraments. Now, Pope Francis hasn't yet responded to the synod, will do apparently within a few weeks. But this book appears just at this juncture where Francis is discerning this question and therefore looks a lot like an attempt to pressurize Francis and to say he can't do this. Sarah's argument is effectively that celibacy is kind of divinely ordained, which really is not a traditional Catholic argument at all. And herein the problem. Here's a campaign to get Francis to say something on this or to resist the synod recommendation and using Pope Emeritus Benedict, as it were, to bolster his position. In a way, the Pope Emeritus's people say he never agreed to. That's the substance of the issue.
I mean, your very revealing article in Commonweal magazine does suggest that this debate over this book is part of a much broader, well, almost culture war within the Catholic Church. So who is Cardinal Robert Sara, the man that you argue has basically co-opted Benedict?
Cardinal Sara is the head of what's called the Congregation for Divine Worship, which is the body in the Vatican responsible for liturgy. Now, he's close to Benedict, and Benedict asked Francis to keep Sara on. Francis put Sara in charge of this congregation, and he's used that position to argue for a series of positions that really are not in accord with the pontificate of Francis, and there's been obvious tension between Sara and the Pope, really, throughout this pontificate, but Francis has kind of put up with him. But I think this goes really beyond the legitimate sort of expressing of a view. The views expressed in this are really closely aligned with the traditionalist wing of the church, who have been extremely critical of Francis. Now, I know, you know, the two popes, and we've had this idea of these two rival factions. In reality, we're talking here about a small but very noisy and educated and well-financed group of people who have been using or attempting to use the Pope Emeritus as a kind of alternative to the Francis papacy. And I think they've done this without Benedict's consent. And this is where I say there's an element of exploitation. Remember, Benedict is 93, extremely frail. And therefore, the idea that he can be consent to this, of course, is very doubtful.
You say, Austin, that it's a relatively small group that's against the Pope. But you even use the word in your essay, schemes. You refer to Cardinal Sara's schemes. What are these schemes? Are they there to undermine the papacy of Francis? Are they there to get Francis to do as his predecessor did, resign?
I don't think they're aiming at causing Francis to resign. I think their aim is to try to shape the next conclave and to take the church in a very different direction from the one that Francis has been taking the church and indeed Pope since the Second Vatican Council. So there's a traditionalist conservative agenda here. As you say, they're very powerful. They're certainly well financed, but I don't think numerically they're that significant. In other words, I think most of the bishops, the cardinals, and the people of God of the world are with the Pope, as Catholics could have ordered. Ordinarily are, but certainly this group is very, very vociferous and vigorous. And when I refer to schemes in the article, I mean, there have been a whole number of these we've had over the last few years. We've had Archbishop Vigano and Cardinal Müller and Cardinal Burke, and these people are part of a group that tends to try to gather around the Pope Emeritus.
Well, there's one person that you reveal, and this was a real revelation to me, and I followed this stuff pretty closely, who seems to be kind of feeding this idea of a rival papacy, and that is the Pope Benedict's private secretary, George Ganschwein, who's an archbishop. What did he say rather ambiguously once about the nature of having two popes?
The Pope Emeritus Benedict has said himself that it was never his idea to be called Pope Emeritus. He believed he should be called the Bishop Emeritus of Rome, shouldn't wear white, but it was Ganswein's idea that he should. So he's very much under Ganswein's influence. And so Ganswein really has been Benedict's gatekeeper. He's the one who controls access to him and has been very much identified with this group that I mentioned earlier, sometimes called the Regensburg Network, because a lot of them are Germans. And Ganswein's really been very much part of them. And he suggested a couple of years ago that the papacy should now be considered in a different way as having a kind of dual papacy. There's an active wing and a contemplative wing. It was a completely ridiculous notion that got shot down by theologians, canonists, and gently by Pope Francis himself on board a plane. So Ganswein's very much linked to this group. But what's interesting in this particular imbroglio, and we need the Italian word to describe this, it really has been an imbroglio, has been that Ganswein has obviously been very angry at Sara and his people using Benedict in this way, because it's Ganswein who said, no, Benedict never agreed to this. And then Archbishop Viganò, arch-critic of Pope Francis, who called on him to resign a couple of years back, pops up and then starts to rubbish Ganswein, you know, in a kind of new communique and saying, well, Ganswein's a control freak. And so what's quite interesting is to see in a way that they're all kind of falling out with each other. But nonetheless, that is the spectacle we've enjoyed of the last week.
You suggest a couple of very concrete ways, though, to clean up this disagreement about the authority of supposedly having two popes. And some of them seem very mundane, but you say they're very important. What are they?
I don't think there's any question, really, that most people now believe that the emeritus papacy, which is, after all, a new institution, needs reforming. We've only had one retired pope, and it's been done badly in the sense that it has caused confusion. To have somebody called still pope, even if it's emeritus, dressing in white, having a kind of court around him, all this is confusing. When Francis steps down, if he steps down, and he's made clear he certainly will consider that, but he's called the Bishop Emeritus of Rome, not the Pope Emeritus. He dresses in ordinary clericals or as a cardinal. In other words, he becomes a private citizen again.
In the event that Francis or another pope in the future retires, should a former pope continue to live inside the Vatican? I mean, it's effectively like, as we say, having someone live in the granny flat of your house.
Yes, and in some ways, you know, that's okay. I mean, Francis said at the beginning of the pontificate, you know, he has a very lovely relationship with Benedict. He says it's like having a grandfather up the road to consult. I don't actually see any problem in principle with the retired pope living in the Vatican, although people close to Francis have always said to me he would like to retire to Buenos Aires. In fact, yeah, he has even a clergy house that he was going to retire to in 2013, where I think they're keeping a room for him, or they would arrange a room for him. And that's why they say he's renewed his Argentine passport. However, I have no idea whether that's true. I think if it's possible for a pope to retire to his, you know, home city and just be a humble pastor, I think that could happen. Why not?
Well, great to talk to you, and we'll come back to you in March to discuss your new book. Austin Ivory, he's now a fellow at Campion Hall at Oxford University. His latest book is Wounded Shepherd, Pope Francis and His Struggle to Convert the Catholic Church. Austin, thanks for being with us on the Religion and Ethics Report.
Thanks, Andrew.
Next Monday, the world marks the 75th anniversary of the liberation of Auschwitz. Soviet troops freed the surviving Jews from a camp that represented the worst of the Holocaust. But fascinatingly, a diplomat from Japan, which was a wartime ally of the Nazis, is an unlikely hero. Chiyune Sugihara defied orders and secretly issued visas to an estimated 6,000 Jews who had fled to Lithuania. Now an Australian first-time filmmaker, Linda Royal, is working on the story of her own family, the Margolins, who were rescued by Sugihara. She's speaking with Alice Moldovan.
My father and my paternal grandparents escaped Warsaw in December 1939 to Lithuania, to Vilna, and found out, as did a lot of the other refugees, that the Dutch and Japanese consulates, in cahoots with each other, were issuing visas illegally to the Jewish refugees, and that was the only way of escape for them.
And so now you're using that story to make a feature film?
So I'm making a feature film which is based on a true story. It's heavily, obviously, based on my personal experience with my father and my grandmother. I never knew my grandfather. He passed away before I was born. And the true story of Sugihara, who was the Japanese diplomat who was stationed in Kaunas in Lithuania, who issued the visas.
What are you hoping to achieve with a movie that, instead of, I don't know, running tours to Japan or volunteering at a museum, like, okay, why this?
Cinema has the reach whatever the subject matter, that no museum can. Most of us learned anything about everything from cinema, whether it's Hitler, Pol Pot, the sexual revolution, whatever. You learn it via movies, and it may not be accurate, but it encourages you to then seek more information and go and look at the facts and documentaries. So it also has the reach. You know, you can't have a Jewish museum or a Holocaust museum in every city in the world.
Some people might say that this story is incredible enough, the fact that he gave so many visas against orders, and it was quite culturally significant that he disobeyed orders as well, coming from his Japanese background. So if it's incredible enough, why the need to embellish it?
Because it's been done already. There are numerous documentaries. There are numerous stage plays in Japan. There's a feature film that the Japanese put out in 2015 called Persona non grata that did not do the story justice. I'm really good friends with Sugihara's only surviving son, Nobuki, and he really didn't like it. And this is a different take. It's inspired by the story of Sugihara, but it's so much more. So we wanted something that was very rich thematically. So it's not just the linear progression of people escaping and the story of what Sugihara did. Anyone can read that. This touches on post-traumatic stress. It touches on the impacts on the next generation in a major way. That's our major theme. It's really the suffering daughter who can't get close to her disconnected father and doesn't understand his trauma and has distanced herself from her faith as a result. So it's all those things. And it is really understanding the man behind the hero, which is what we were trying to do when we were interviewing Nobuki, his son. We really got a really good impression of it was his character to just do this. It just came naturally to him. He had disobeyed and gone against the norm many, many times in his life. It was just him, and really just to portray him like nobody else had ever portrayed him before, and at a time where it was years past what he'd done and the impacts on him and the impacts on the survivors.
How have other people, either from the survivors and descendants groups or other people not connected to the story, what's the response been like?
Oh.
And have you had any criticism?
Well, it wasn't even a criticism. It was a questioning by one of the descendants who, when I was up asking them for funding, if they wanted to help out, said, why should we give money to you, you know, rather than people who are doing documentaries? And when I pitched to them the fact that the bottom line is that people want to be entertained and that's really the way to get to them, and that it has a really important job, even as much or more so than a museum, they were pretty much convinced. Other survivors and other descendants think it's a very noble thing that I'm doing, because they think that any education and anything that highlights anti-Semitism and educates the world on the Holocaust is a valuable tool.
Especially when it's so difficult for a lot of people to even tell the difference between a real news story and a fake news story, mm-hmm. and the fact that people are getting their news in bite-sized chunks from Facebook and quickly on their phone, not reading in depth. Is it likely that people are going to watch this, be entertained and understand some of those themes? Mm-hmm. That's one thing, but are they likely to go and do their own research, or will they just say, that was nice, moving on?
If they do their own research, they won't find anything to the contrary. This is based on a true story and inspired by my family's escape and what happened to my family. It's my family's story, but it represents all of us as survivors. It has nothing to do with the personal story. If they go and Google Sugihara, in my story, the protagonist and her grandmother go to Kobe and meet fellow survivors. There were plenty of people who have visited Kobe to retrace their footsteps and see what it's like, because they all lived there for 6 months with the Jewish community there. There won't be anything untrue, and we will have survivors educating the young protagonist on what it was like to be in whatever places they came from, Warsaw, Bialystok, wherever, and the intricacies and finer details of that escape and that journey and the persecution that they left behind.
That's filmmaker Linda Royal speaking with RN's Alice Moldova about the story of Chiyune Sugihara, who was the Japanese diplomat who rescued 6,000 Jews during World War II. Finally, 2019 wasn't quite another annus horribilis for Queen Elizabeth, but she used her recent message at Christmas to say that it had been a bumpy ride.
Of course, at the heart of the Christmas story lies the birth of a child, a seemingly small and insignificant step overlooked by many in Bethlehem. But in time, through his teaching and by his example, Jesus Christ would show the world how small steps, taken in faith and in hope, can overcome long-held differences and deep-seated divisions to bring harmony and understanding. Many of us already try to follow in his footsteps. The path, of course, is not always smooth, and may at times this year have felt quite bumpy.
Indeed. Now, devotees of the annual broadcast have noticed that in the past 5 or 6 years, the Queen has spoken more explicitly about her faith. So in a year that's seen Prince Andrew go to ground after allegations of a sex scandal, and now Prince Harry and Meghan retreat to Canada, how much is the Queen resting on her faith? US writer Dudley Defs is the author of a new book, The Faith of Queen Elizabeth.
Perhaps part of this new, more overt kind of faith in the annual Christmas broadcast emerges because of having lost the Queen Mom, having lost Princess Margaret, and of course both of those in the same year, 2002, I believe. But then just being 93 years old, I think she certainly has to have her own mortality in mind and history and legacy. And I think she realizes that her Christian faith is a central part of that legacy.
How seriously does she take the role that was given to her at her coronation as defender of the faith? I mean, first of all, what does it mean?
Well, of course, it's one of those curious titles that's part of the legacy of Henry VIII. Defender of the faith was a title that was a kind of consolation prize or conciliatory gesture by the Pope to finally make peace with this break with the church that Henry made so that, of course, he could marry whom he wanted and, you know, try to have that male heir he wanted. And so the title itself has a rather dubious history and yet has become entrenched as part of the monarchy and a clear and central facet of it. And what I appreciate about Queen Elizabeth's handling of that role is that, like so many others, she has been very gentle and yet very firm, because I think it could easily be nothing but a ceremonial role. But I think she has been an incredible example. She attends church faithfully weekly. She does pray. She references the Bible. She has become more overt in her annual Christmas broadcasts. I loved what she did as part of her Diamond Jubilee with Scripture Union and the Bible Society and producing this wonderful little booklet on Her Majesty the Queen and the King She Serves, which, you know, several hundred thousand copies went out. And basically, it's very direct about her faith and trust in Jesus Christ.
What did she say in the coronation pledge? What did she say about upholding the gospel?
That is a very explicit part of her coronation vows. That's the first vow, in fact, that the Archbishop of Canterbury makes as part of that ceremony, and the first one the Queen took before the state, before the Commonwealth, before anything else. It is a commitment directly to God, a relationship between herself and the sovereign. I think she has demonstrated time and time again that she sees that as a kind of divine calling and not one necessarily that she would have chosen herself, but yet she has refused to shirk it or to denigrate it or to turn it into a kind of pedestal for her own ego or self-aggrandizement. I think she has tried to steward the monarchy and all that it entails, even while helping it change and evolve into our 21st century.
How has her religious faith also shaped the way that she has approached some big international crises and problems, especially in the area, for example, of race and racism?
Well, I think her religious views guided her to transcend or to go beyond what was perhaps politically expedient. There are conflicted interests involving the United Kingdom's business interests. Certainly, you know, with Prime Minister Thatcher and her reluctance to impose sanctions.
Yeah, we should just point out that in the 1980s, when Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher was strongly against economic sanctions against apartheid South Africa, the Queen, as much as she can take a position for a neutral monarch, is believed by numerous biographers and insiders to have taken a position that was, no, we have to stand up to apartheid. And she did make a very big deal, I think, of receiving Nelson Mandela, even before he was the president of South Africa, at Buckingham Palace.
Yes. And of course, there was a leaked news story in one of the Sunday tabloids claiming Her Majesty was, you know, very unhappy with Prime Minister Thatcher for several reasons. But this was certainly a large part of them, this resistance to sanctions and to taking measures that would force the end of apartheid in South Africa. So even when the Queen has been very limited in her role in terms of how to maneuver, it seems to me that she has always found a way to exert influence.
Those of us who've been watching the Netflix series The Crown will recall the story of the Queen's encounter with Billy Graham, the American evangelist. Given that she has a very traditional, some would say rather staid view of the way to worship and to practice one's religion, what do we know of her relationship with Billy Graham?
Queen Elizabeth II and the Reverend Billy Graham had this lifelong friendship that did indeed begin, as we see dramatized, it's episode 6 with that great German title, Vergangenheit, which means the past. And of course, Her Majesty, you know, is struggling with how to forgive her Uncle David and these new revelations about his involvement or betrayal during World War II. And that coinciding with Reverend Graham's first major crusade there in London and her invitation then to have him come preach at Windsor in the chapel. Reverend Graham is very direct and explicit in his autobiography about this friendship that continued. And he comments that even though Her Majesty cannot be as direct and explicit about speaking of the gospel or of her faith, that she nonetheless demonstrates this faith that is just bedrock solid and incredibly inspiring.
What do we know about the sensibilities of her heir, Prince Charles?
Andrew, I think we know that Prince Charles has a more liberal sensibility, if you will, a more libertine view, perhaps, of the church's role in modern culture and society. Perhaps, you know, has a more relevant view, one might argue, because of the personal history he has had with divorce and scandal in the public eye. But now, in his 70s and taking on more responsibilities in preparation to be king, it seems very likely that the future King Charles, if you will continue to have this same consistency of behavior, of respect, and of stewarding not just the monarchy, but the church and being defender of the faith as well.
Although I think he has said that he rather likes the idea of being defender of faith as opposed to simply the faith. I guess that's an interesting take.
Oh, I think that's a very astute observation, and we can make of that what we will. That will certainly upset some people and perhaps trouble some church traditionalists and wanting to maintain a singular the Christian faith. In many ways, it reflects the necessity of being inclusive. And if nothing else, it keeps the conversation about personal faith alive in an era when so many people consider it irrelevant.
Dudley Deffs, author of The Faith of Queen Elizabeth, and that's this week's Religion and Ethics Report. Next week, philosopher Jessica White, she discusses her new book, The Morals of the Market. She explores how neoliberals have used post-World War II ideas of human rights to promote a free market agenda, and we ask what role religion played in both helping and hindering that crusade. But that is the program for this week. Thanks to Mutta Tadias and Bryce Halliday. I'm Andrew West. Back next week.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.